The city's Downtown Investment Authority makes major moves to develop Jacksonville's urban core. We'll take your calls on that in just a moment. Good Thursday morning, a chilly one, live from Studio 5. We are warm and heating things up here on First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. First Coast Connect is always live on the radio, and now you can also catch our daily podcast on iTunes. Just ahead, we want your calls on big plans for the city's urban core. What are your thoughts about downtown? Get on the line now, 549-2937. Then later, all about the growth of Jasmine, helping LGBT kids in our area. Plus, it's the tastiest event in town. We'll have a preview of the new Three Squares benefiting Feeding Northeast Florida. All of that ahead. But first this morning, from Shad Khan's exciting new plans for the shipyards to the Healthy Town development on the South Bank, although it's changing its name, and changes in store for the Jacksonville Landing and the historic Laura Street Trio. Lots of momentum lately when it comes to major improvements in downtown Jacksonville. And the Downtown Investment Authority is in charge of redeveloping the city's urban core. The DIA coming out with ambitious plans for both the north and south banks of the St. Johns River, and long-term goals that include developing vacant tracts of city-owned property and bringing 10,000 new residents to downtown. So we begin the hour this morning with a closer look at all this as the DIA leadership joins us in studio. Here today, DIA CEO Andre Wallace. Hey, Andre, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And Oliver Barakat, chairman of the Downtown Investment Authority's governing board. Hi, Oliver.
Good morning, Melissa.
And here's our question to callers. We want to know right now, what are your thoughts about these ambitious plans to develop Jacksonville's urban core? What are your thoughts about downtown? Get on the line now. 549-2937, that's 549-2937, or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. We also welcome your Facebook comments. Andre, let's begin with you. A lot to discuss when it comes to the DIA's big look at everything, but first off, Shad Khan the other day came out with his plans for redeveloping the long-vacant shipyards property. What was your reaction to that news?
Reaction first was, in looking at it, it was a good vision, good concept for the property. It aligns with the downtown feasibility study that was prepared for the Downtown Investment Authority in April of last year. We saw the aspects of live, work, play, stay in their particular proposal. So from that aspect, we were very pleased that they followed the actual market study.
And how does that fit into your overall vision for downtown development? Because, as I said, you have control now over some funds and some plans to, in particular, develop the North and the South Bank, among other things.
Correct. In our plan, the shipyards is one of the particular projects that we considered a catalytic site, catalytic project for downtown. But we also knew that it was a long-range, long-term particular project that would need a well-financed developer to take on that particular project. So in the event that from the vision and concept that we saw Tuesday of this week leads itself to an actual proposal that comes forward to us, mm-hmm. I think that you're looking at being able to utilize that proposal and solicit other proposals as well for us to compare to make a determination about who's the right has the right vision and concept for the shipyards.
Lots of calls, meanwhile, as we speak with the leadership of the Downtown Investment Authority. Let us know what you think about efforts to improve the urban core. We'll go to your calls in a moment, 549-2937. Oliver, how do you see all of these pieces fitting together in terms of a comprehensive change, whether it's the DIA's long-range plan, Shad Khan doing what he's doing, Peter Rummel developing that piece on the South Bank and other things, the landing? How do you see all of this fitting together?
Well, I think one of our goals of our plan was to approach downtown development holistically and not look at each project on a standalone basis and look at and try to determine how these projects will impact one another. So when we consider the shipyards project and the velocity of space that may come online with that project, how will that impact the landing and the uses that may be proposed on the landing? How will that impact the courthouse project and the land owned by the city surrounding the old courthouse, as well as the GAA site now owned by Peter Rummel's group. So we'll have to be very deliberative and judicious and very thoughtful about how these projects are staged over time, How many units are being delivered over time, and can our market absorb those?
Sure. And in terms of your long-range goals for 2025, developing vacant tracts, getting 10,000 new residents, how do you see the path forward to getting the funding to be able to do that?
Well, I think that's one of the challenges, obviously, that the city will have over time. And I think one of the goals for the DIA is to advocate for further funding. What we need in Jacksonville is consistent funding towards downtown. I think in the past, our approach has been either to be, react to a development that's approaching the city, but we need to have a consistent year in, year out funding source dedicated to downtown so we can address the needs of these developments as they come along.
And Andre Wallace, the whole rationale for creating the Downtown Investment Authority is to provide continuity over many years, protected from the winds of different mayoral administrations and different politicians that come and go. What do you see as some of the major challenges to executing your vision for all of this?
As Oliver indicated, we're going to need two things: the financial resources as well as the human capital equal as well, to make sure that we're able to deliver this particular vision and the actual plan that we have. Also, we're going to need a very good working relationship with the development community to bring these particular projects to fruition. Let's be honest, public sector will not have all the money to do this. So we're going to have to rely heavily upon the private sector to bring dollars to the market. And we're going to have to be shrewd and strategic about the development partnerships that we take on to make sure they deliver the projects.
Let me add to that, Melissa. We're not only seeing interest from large developers like Tony Slayman or Peter Rummel or Shad Khan, but in the last several years, we've seen small businesses in some cases risk their life savings, risk capital to open up these businesses, very creative businesses downtown that have been very successful. So the private sector—
Like what? Can you give us an example?
Sweet Pete's.
Sweet Pete's, sure.
Yeah, the Calford Chop House that is proposed, bars like the Volstead, Chomp Chomp. I mean, there's lots of small businesses that are very creative, independently owned, and that of all the places to locate down in Jacksonville, they've chosen downtown. So the private sector is at the table, and the public sector needs to continue to be at the table year in, year out.
And we'll go to your calls right now as we speak with Andre Wallace, CEO, and Oliver Bearcat, board chair, chair of the governing board of the city's Downtown Investment Authority. When it comes to the urban core, what are your thoughts? What are your questions? 549-2937. John on the south side begins our callers this morning. Hey, John, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Good morning, Andra and Oliver. And thank you for taking my call. You know, for this announcement, with the shipyards, in partnership, really, with these other announced projects that are coming with the landing and then the JEA site, this continuity and for a sustainable, just funding source going forward. My concern, and maybe it'll be addressed Tuesday at the DIA board meeting, which is at 3:00 and open to the public, and I hope every media outlet is there. What will be the part of the shipyards, from the water standpoint? Because right now, I just don't see it. And I think that it should be a huge concern for this community, especially from that study that identified a 4.8-mile river's edge zone from the 401 to the Matthews Bridge. So will there be opportunity for the little guy and not just the big guys?
Yeah. Thanks, John, for the call. Andre Wallace.
John, as you've attended a lot of our public meetings, there's always an opportunity for the little guy. A lot of, if not most of everything that we've done has been centered around the actual little guy. So with regards to any particular component of a proposal or something of that nature, we're always going to be looking at it from how does it engage with the St. Johns River. That's the best asset that we have in downtown.
Oliver.
In the plan that was just approved by City Council, the DIA had seven goals. One of them was waterfront public access. So that is something we'll be looking for in every development proposed on the river.
And that, of course, includes the latest iteration of the landings plans, which is still not finalized, but that's a big part of the changes envisioned there too, right?
With regards to the Jacksonville landing, we have a request for proposal that is on the street. We'll be receiving proposals next week to procure an urban waterfront design professional to work with us to create a vision for the Jacksonville landing. And I think it's perfect timing, understanding what the proposed vision is for, I know the name will change, Healthy Town, expecting a potential proposal for the shipyards, and then now being able to take a look at the landing. We'll be, as Oliver indicated, we'll be able to look at all these projects holistically.
Lisa in Jacksonville. Lisa, thanks for holding. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on. I'm a traveling nurse here in Jacksonville, and my husband is on the medical staff for Wilson's Children's Hospital. I travel throughout Jacksonville and know that there are certain issues with regards to the site down on the river, being that this ground soil, and there are issues there with regards to public health and creating a site there that would be cleaned up. How important and what is being done in as regards to putting that in a prioritized issue? I mean, is that going to be something they're going to take care of first before they decide to develop that area, or even allow good money to be put into building something there?
Yeah, thanks, Lisa, for the call and the question.
Sure, Lisa. With regards to your question, almost 2 months ago, the city went forward and procured someone to do an assessment for the shipyard's property. You're absolutely correct. There's contamination there. We're trying to identify what's the assessment cost going to be for remediation. That has to take place first before anything can happen with regards to development on the site.
Sally in St. John's. Hey, Sally, go ahead. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hey. I've never heard a really good reason why the taxpayers should have to fund or pay for anything to do with improving downtown. If businesses can't make money there, then why should the taxpayers have to spend money on it? I mean, there's lots of places in Jacksonville that could use improvement. Why should the taxpayers do it? I don't understand that.
Sally, thanks for that. Oliver, what about that question?
Yeah, it's a great point, particularly in a city with consolidated government and a city as large as Jacksonville, where you have residents that live far away from the downtown and maybe disconnected from it. I think one of the many points is that the city's brand and identity is based on the downtown's image. So if you live in a neighborhood and if you don't either live or work or play in downtown, the economic health of your neighborhood is tied to the economic performance of your downtown. So I think that as we have these elections, and if you think back to the last elections, there was a bit of a referendum on the city's desire for a better downtown. We had one candidate that was very pro-downtown, and he was the ultimate winner. And I think
candidate said, I don't think it's important.
I think at best he was agnostic to downtown development.
Yeah, you think that made a difference?
I do.
In the election?
Really do. I do think it made a difference.
Mike in Jacksonville. Hey, Mike. Thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. My question kind of stems from the previous question. I don't think it's just that the taxpayers are getting the bill, but we're also kind of being asked to just, we're not getting a lot of the financial benefit. Those aren't apparent. I mean, I think we look at things like the $40 million video boards on the stadium, which are actually ad platforms that the city doesn't, we had to pay for those, but we're not getting the ad revenue from them. I think that people look at what was arguably a good deal for Slayman with the landing that has been met with, I don't see how too many people can look at that and not see a complete lack of vision with that one. And I think a lot of people in Jacksonville feel that we're footing the bill for a lot of folks to fund their projects, and then they're taking all the profit and not giving back to Jacksonville the profit. They're using the excuse that, oh, well, you get the benefits of all this other stuff that trickles down. And that really that's a lot of hucksterism, really. I think you need to be a little bit more concrete than just vague promises about identity. I mean, there's very real financial needs that need to be met by the city. Yes, the rising tide lifts all ships, but I think the city needs to get back hard dollars from this as well, or, you know, part of the gross, if you will.
Thanks, Mike. Andre.
Yes, Mike, with regards to your statement and comments, at the Downtown Investment Authority, we're going to be making strategic business decisions. I cannot speak to what happened in the past, but we do know that everything that we do is scrutinized very heavily, and we are looking at what's the rate of return back to the city.
And you have to make that case.
And we have to clearly make the case. Remember, the Downtown Investment Authority only has so much amount of resources. So anything that we do will require us to partner with the city administration, and we have to build our case for why this particular project should move forward.
Rick in Avondale. Hello, Rick. What are your thoughts?
Well, as a longtime resident, I am thrilled with all the plans that are coming to the downtown area. My concern is really population. Do we really have the numbers of people that live in our downtown, or not downtown, all Jacksonville as a whole? I think it's 1 million-plus people that we have, and Is the dynamic of the number of people that can actually live and work in these areas addressed as the growth continues?
Thanks, Rick. Lots of good calls today. Oliver.
Yeah, I think that I saw a statistic recently where I was comparing the millennial growth of population in the metropolitan area, and Duval County saw, on a percentage basis, more millennials moving into the county than in St. John's, Nassau, or Baker County, or even Clay County. So we are seeing an influx of young people come into Jacksonville, and that is the demographic that is growing downtowns all over the United States. And you also have another demographic of growing empty nesters, the baby boom generation. As their kids leave the house, they're looking for an urban lifestyle. So cities all over the United States have seen this demographic shift, have capitalized on it. And I think with the growing resurgence of Riverside and Springfield and these very successful historic neighborhoods surrounding the core, I think that demand has manifested itself in those neighborhoods. And so downtown is ready to capitalize on it.
Lots of tweets. Mickey, no one visits a city to hang out in the suburbs. People come to see the downtown. Think of Savannah. Bill tweets the show. Redevelopment of downtown Jacks will drive growth across all counties. Funding and private sector engagement is key. Success breeds success. Lee tweets the show. How will the DIA incentivize people to move downtown? And on Facebook, another question. How will the DIA incentivize private development? So people have a lot of questions about incentives. Andre Wallace.
With regards on the private development side, one of the things that we're looking at from an incentive aspect is how do we actually make the deal work? And if it means that we need to be in a position of assisting them with some relaxations on the actual taxes itself, they pay their taxes, but we then utilizing a portion of that to help them meet their rate of return to actually take on the actual development project with the financial institution funding them, then we're willing to actually look at that. I think as we grow and new development comes on, we may very well may need to look at how to incentivize from a residential aspect of people living in downtown. Yeah. I've worked in other cities that have utilized that same.
How would that
tool.
Work? How would you do that?
I mean, number one, it can very well be do you actually incentivize them from a rental aspect, assisting them, bringing the actual rental rate down so they actually can execute the actual lease and move into the actual downtown, maybe do it for a 12-month, 24-month period. Once you get someone living in that particular area and they begin to like it, then they're actually going to be able to want to stay there, and they'll be able to afford things as their salaries continue to grow.
A few more Facebook comments. Jenny wants to know, what about alternative transportation options and infrastructure, pedestrians, bikers? Angela, with the Liberty Street Bridge collapse and the Acosta Bridge lights burning out, how can we see funding towards our aging infrastructure? Questions about whether we can get a new convention center that will help downtown. A question about whether that aquarium project is realistic to add to downtown. Oliver, lots of interest in this, lots of questions.
Yeah, I think it goes back to the funding question and having a dedicated revenue source towards many of these projects. As far as alternative modes of transportation, in the plan that the DIA just got approved through City Council, We have a years table which specifies actual projects year by year, and one of those are cycle tracks connecting Springfield to downtown, a couple of north-south cycle tracks, and an east-west cycle track connecting Riverside to downtown. So we have thought through creating better linkages and alternative modes of transportation downtown, and all of this is going to require some going back to the funds question and the funds conversation.
It all goes back to that. Yeah. Speaking of which, here's one for you, Andre. A tweet, downtown is part of Council District 7. It houses Bacardi and Budweiser. Are these multinational corporations investing back into downtown Jacksonville?
Great question.
Yeah. yeah.
I think that's a relationship that needs to be built with those particular industries to get them to invest more into downtown core. I do know that with Budweiser being here in the Margaritaville concept, Landshark from our beer aspect, being able to link those to that particular restaurant concept to downtown Jacksonville with the Budweiser plant being here is a good way to begin that dialogue and conversation.
Sure. Let's go now to Susie on the south side. Hey, Susie, good morning.
Hey. I don't know how bonds actually work, but maybe that's an avenue to look at. I think this whole thing is contorting around the issue of money and support. People, are kind of upset that they can't get potholes fixed, and now we're going to do all these things, and they don't want to pick up the tab for it. And it kind of makes me laugh. I think about the Shark Tank shows. If this isn't worth private investors picking it up for themselves, then it's really not worth us backing and lining their pockets, in my opinion.
Thanks, Susie.
Well, I would say that all real estate development has some kind of government help. Government builds roads in the suburbs, it builds infrastructure in the suburbs. So all real estate development has some kind of government subsidy along with it. And I think downtown, the infrastructure for the most part is already in place. But because of the cost of verticality of going up and the cost of building parking garages, the government needs to get involved to reduce costs in other ways. And also, let me also say, if downtown does become successful as we want it to be, you have some of the city's most potential valuable real estate that can create tremendous tax revenues in the years and decades to come. And that tax revenue could be spread to other parts of the community, help us keep libraries open and a strong police force. So you have waterfront property, high-density buildings located next to two major interstate highways, a downtown that's the geographic center of the city. I mean, it has tremendous tax revenue potential if it realizes.
And Andre Wallace, that's always been the refrain. Look at all this potential. Mm-hmm. The challenge is realizing the potential. That's been difficult for many years.
As Oliver indicated, downtown probably in the past generated somewhere between 16% of revenue for the actual city's budget. Now it's down to less than 5%. So if we're going to be successful in making sure we're able to have revenue distribution to other areas of the city, you need to get that revenue-producing neighborhood of downtown back up into that 10 to 15% of revenue generation to the city.
Let's take one more call. It's Carl on the south side. Hey, Carl, thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Yes. In the video shown by the Jaguars and Shad Khan, that they were showing the river was blue, and it
I noticed
made me
that.
Laugh.
Yeah, so, I noticed that too.
Yeah, so it made me laugh. One of the things we have to consider is if we're going to be having this, if we're going to be showcasing Jacksonville to the world, and I fully support this project. The amphitheater, I think, could be like the Sydney Opera House style. It would be in it. Also can help bring the Super Bowl back to Jacksonville. But how can we try to, work to clean up the river, things like connecting people that live on the river to sewer instead of septic tank, and where they just connect, you can't have raw sewage in the river. And then also like Palatka, there's issues going on there with their paper mill, and they're trying to pump water away from the St. John's River. We need to make sure to fight to keep that water blue so people will actually want to be out near the river. And then that's one point, because I know that the Downtown Investment Authority and can have some sway as far as, demanding that the river is cleaned up. And then also if they do dredging, there could be some other ramifications as well. So we have to think about that. Also, what about parking? Because one of the case studies about the town center, why it's so successful, is that it has plenty of parking, and also it's centralized. But, you know, what can be done about really just taking care of the parking problem downtown? Because that's a big problem.
You know what, though, Carl, and the only reason I say this back to you is so many guests on the show have pointed this out to me. There is plenty of parking in downtown Jacksonville. People just don't realize it, Oliver.
Yeah, especially in the evening when all the office workers are
And there's a million garages. People don't like having to drive in a garage and pay it. So it's another mindset if you're coming into an urban environment, right?
It just needs to be better organized by one central authority. And we are developing a liaison relationship with the city's parking departments, and we're trying to stay close to a lot of the parking owners, private parking owners downtown, so it's better managed. As far as the river, real quick, I'll say I think it comes down to out of sight, out of mind. If people want a healthier river, stay connected to your river. And I think to the extent we can increase public access in the downtown waterfront and people are connected to the river, they'll think more about it and demand a healthier river.
And about its health, yeah. Yep. He made a great point, Andre. My husband commented on those renderings, too. He's like, wow, that's the bluest river I've ever seen. But if I could ask you, as you look ahead, your agenda for the next several years, what are your final thoughts?
We're going to be very busy. That is definitely my final thoughts on that. Which is good. Someone asked me yesterday, well, you've got potentially healthy town, you've got potentially a project at the shipyards, you've got a project at the landing. How do you prioritize? I said, you know, competition is good. And if, think about Jacksonville 10 years from now, we got all three of those particular projects brought online and come to fruition, that would be great for downtown Jacksonville.
Well, we thank you both so much for sharing all this important news with us. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Wilson.
Andre Wallace is the CEO and Oliver Bearcat, chair of the board of the Downtown Investment Authority. And much more still ahead. Later, a delicious preview of Three Squares, dining out to feed the hungry and food insecure in our area. We'll tell you how you can be part of that. But up next, the growth of Jasmine. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9.
From the moment you wake up, through the chaos of your busy morning, Morning Edition is there with you.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. Protesters have been
through all you have to do, we'll bring you all you need to know every weekday on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings beginning at 5 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
WJCTnews.org is your source for the latest local, national, and international news 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Podcasts of your favorite local stories and shows, the WJCT First Read every weekday morning, and playlists from all of our after-hours music programming. From your computer or mobile device, see it all at WJCTnews.org.
WJCT and the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville are accepting submissions from local artists for The Square. The Square is an online venue where local artists share their work with the community and compete for a chance to be featured on WJCT TV and radio. Submit now through March 31st. To learn more about The Square and to submit your work, visit wjct.org/thesquare.
This Friday on Closing the Loop, Catherine Tapuni has been a school teacher, fitness coach, and construction industry instructor. If she ever had a comfort zone, she's left it behind for what she's doing now, though. Closing the Loop, every Friday during Morning Edition and All Things Considered on 89.9 WJCT.
Closing the Loop is sponsored in part by First Coast Home Pros, local specialists in carpet, grout, and upholstery cleaning.
Welcome back. Well, the local nonprofit Jasmine is expanding with a brand new building and also a bigger footprint in the community. Now, Jasmine has been around for some 20 years, but recently the organization, which serves LGBT youth, has seen a sharp increase in demand for services. Lots to share. Here with more, we welcome Executive Director Cindy Watson. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And Dr. Paul Schilling, who has donated this new building or a way to get it. Very exciting news. Dr. Schilling, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Cindy, let's begin with you. You're opening up a building next door to your original property.
That's right. So now we think we have a campus, Melissa.
A whole
a
campus.
Jasmine campus with two buildings. We're gonna pack both of them out with lots of services and programs. And the new building that Dr. Schilling and Dr. Dutton, his partner, have made possible for us really will help us expand our services.
How so? Tell us about your impetus to donate this and what people can look forward to, Doctor.
Well, Jay and I are interested in helping, certainly helping people, but also we have a track history of kind of helping the most vulnerable populations. And we felt that the LGBT youth included that group. We had been giving donations to Jasmine for some time, and we actually visited their current building, and we felt that they were really bursting at the seams, and I think they would say the same. And one time we were visiting, and we noticed that the building next door was for sale, and I said, well, why don't we think about negotiating to buy it? And we would be able to do that since we're unrelated. Neither of us were on the Jasmine board at the time. Mm. And the building had been vacant for a number of years, and so we managed to get it, and we put some money in to try to bring it up to spec, so to speak. And so that's what we did.
So what this means then, Cindy, is more kids aged 13 to 23 will get access to case management, clinical care, counseling, just a whole range of services,
right? That's exactly right. We'll be able to more than double our time that we're able to provide clinic space for HIV and STD testing. And we will have lots of opportunities to do that one-on-one support and guidance for young people who are homeless or who are HIV positive. So some of our most high-risk youth will benefit incredibly by the additional space.
Now, recently on 89.9, we've been airing a series in partnership with Jasmine and StoryCorps, the much-loved national storytelling series. As people sort of reminisce about their childhood growing up LGBT, and people tell really moving and powerful stories. Mm-hmm. They've been fascinating to listen to.
Haven't they?
And at the same time, we're hearing from you that you've had such an increase in demand for services. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, times change, but they haven't changed enough yet. And particularly for young people in this community, there's still a sizable number of youth who experience hostility, discrimination, and rejection from their families and their communities. And so those are the kids that we open our arms and say, come in, we'll help. We'll help connect you to services. We'll help get you to a safe place.
It can be a life-altering experience for some of these kids, can't it, Doctor?
Yes, and we hope that it is a life-altering experience for them to have someone help take care of their needs, which also includes everything from food to counseling and other things.
Just all means of support. So you're excited then to talk about this big celebration on Sunday. You tell us what's going to be happening?
We are. We're having a kind of a two-part celebration and open house. And the public is invited from 2 to 4:30. And there'll be house tours, and there'll be storyboards telling the story of what Jasmine does, who it serves, who its clients are, and the things that are actually needed to continue the mission of Jasmine.
So there's a earlier reception that's hosted by Dr. Schilling and Dr. Dutton from noon to 2, and that's by invitation. And then we really do encourage everyone in the community who wants to see the Jasmine House, who's been friends or wants to be a friend of Jasmine to come on out 2:30 to 4:30 in the afternoon on Sunday for the open house.
And let's, so for people that don't know where you're located.
The new building is 929 Peninsular Place, right next door to our current facility at 923 Peninsular Place. And so that's our campus.
That's Riverside,
right? That's in Riverside, yeah. Just off of Park Street. That's right.
Well, it's exciting. And thank you both for joining us with this positive news to share. We appreciate your time today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And we were joined by Jasmine Executive Director Cindy Watson and donor Dr. Paul Schilling. Again, that event is Sunday at 2:30 in Riverside. And we're back in a moment.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, a drawn-out dispute between shipping companies and dock workers is threatening vital ports along the West Coast. The White House sent Labor Secretary Perez to help broker an agreement. The West Coast port slowdown and implications for the U.S. economy. Weekdays at 10, right after First Coast Connect on 89.9 FM WJCT.
Travel back in time with Radio Theater, Doo-Wop Revival, The Great American Songbook, and Juke Joint. Throwback Sunday, Sunday nights beginning at 7 on 89.9 WJZT. Looking forward to looking back.
Tonight, Lee, the Oscar nominations are out, and they're so white, a grand jury has decided not to indict them.
On the next Fresh Air, Larry Wilmore, host of The Nightly Show, the new program that follows The Daily Show on Comedy Central. Wilmore used to be The Daily Show's senior black correspondent. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Looking for something different musically? Listen to After Hours weeknights at 7 on 89.9 FM, from classical to country.
Give me a word, give me a sign. Show me where to look and tell me what will I find. What will I find? Lay me on the ground, fly me in the sky. Show me where to look and tell me what will I find. What will I find?
Morning Edition is everywhere.
Lourdes Garcia,
Ari Shapiro,
NPR News,
Monrovia,
Sao Paulo,
Beirut,
London. Reporting from bunkers, streets, alleys, jungles, and deserts. But most importantly, we're wherever you are. Start your day with a trip around the world and wake up with Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings beginning at 5 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Welcome back. Well, we want your responses to the next book we're featuring on our show in our First Coast Connect Book Club. Now, next week, our own book club blogger Stacey Goldring will discuss a book called The Sense of an Ending by author Julian Barnes. It's about a retired man who recalls his high school clique and how his memories have changed over time. The story deals with themes of memory. And you don't have to have read this book to be part of our book club. All you have to do is send us an email with your thoughts about your high school memories. What do you remember most about those years? And do you feel like certain things have changed when you compare your memories with other people from that time in your life? Just send us your thoughts about that so that we can read them on the air next week, and you will be part of our book club. Again, that's The Sense of an Ending, the next book we'll feature. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Well, finally, this hour, dozens of this area's top restaurants are taking part in a delicious event next week. It's called Three Squares, and it will be serving up amazing food and drinks next Thursday night at the Prime Osborne Convention Center. Now, all the money raised will go toward Feeding Northeast Florida, providing food to more than 150 food pantries across 17 counties in our area. Executive Director Bruce Ganger is here now to tell us all about it. And Bruce, this sounds really tasty. Good
morning.
This is
going to be a real, real cool party. Hi, Melissa. This is going to be a real cool party. We have the restaurant and beverage community has come back to us and said, look, Bruce, we really want to help you feed people. And the best way we can do that is by applying our talents and our trade and our, you know, our talents into this. So they have come together, an amazing group of people have come together to put together this program, and we're really, really excited about it. We have 50 of the best restaurants in Jacksonville who will come bring a couple, three of their favorite things to compete amongst themselves.
Nice.
For the, real nice.
We are the beneficiaries of that, yes.
Absolutely, and it's one of those things where you challenge anybody who can eat their way through the whole event. It's pretty amazing.
You've got Matthews, Bistro X, Taco Lou, Intuition, Ale Works, let's see who else, BB's, Aqua Grill, Biscotti's, Black Sheep, Campeachy Bay,
Taverna, Avente, mm-hmm. I mean, the list goes on and on and on.
Dos Gatos, Hawker's, a great new place, and it goes on from there. The Loop, M Shack, you name it, great food, Orsay. They're all going to be there serving up really good stuff. And by the way, why is it called Three Squares?
It's sort of a play, sort of a play on three square meals a day.
Oh, okay, there you go. Yeah, sure.
Right?
Duh.
and also the volunteer organizing committee happens to be three kind of square guys. So they're so it all works out.
Very nice.
Right.
Well, they're doing such a good deed because, as we said, all the money raised will go to feed people in 17 counties.
Yeah, it's a big service area. It's 11,000 square miles, 2.1 million people. One out of six of them don't know if, how, when they will next eat today. So as we tell people on any given day, 322,000 people count on feeding Northeast Florida to get this right and make sure that we've got food available to them in those communities.
Let's talk a little bit more about Feeding Northeast Florida and its mission. It's a new entity on the First Coast. It has the affiliation with Second Harvest, the big national food distributor.
Feeding America,
excuse me.
That's right.
I'm getting my food banks named incorrectly. But because you're an arm of Feeding America, you have all of those resources. It makes it easier. But can you talk a little bit about a lot of the challenges you face as you try to address this huge issue?
Yeah, it's a broad issue. And the issue, the biggest issue we face is that there is no one demographic to hunger. So the statistics of a study that we partnered with Feeding America to do and published last fall shows that one out of six people across the population, but they break down to say that 29% of them have a high school or a technical degree or more. 50% are Caucasian, 40% African American, 18% are over the age of 65, 18% are under 18. So you can't just say that that person, 40% of them are working families. You can't just say that that one group is how you have to go solve the issue of hunger. So each of those different constituencies, urban, suburban, rural, now placed upon that, have different issues and different needs. The only common thing they have is the only thing they have in common is that they're all hungry. So our challenge is, how do you go find homebound seniors? How do you go address the issues of veterans? How do you go find children? How do you go help working families, whether they're in the urban core or rural? It really becomes a complex business that we're trying to address.
And what are your biggest strategic goals over the next year or so? Because this is still a fairly new entity for this area.
Yeah, we've in the first 7 months of operation in 2014, we moved over 10 million pounds of food. That's the equivalent of about 8.5 million meals. We'll get close to 20 million pounds of food this year in 2015. So we're growing rapidly. Our whole business model is built around distribution, so not about warehousing a bit. Once we know we have access to a certain kind of food or quantity of food, we know exactly where we want to put it through our distribution network. And so our goals are really to ramp up the distribution, and also at the same time, we're starting to work with community collaborations to address different constituencies, so homebound seniors and children and veterans mm-hmm. and other things in the community, so that we can accelerate our impact in the community through these collaborations and not take that all on ourselves, which I think is critical to the community's success. It's not about Feeding Northeast Florida. It's about the hungry folks in the community and what can we be as a resource or an advocate on their behalf.
So when people come out to Three Squares and buy a ticket, they'll be directly funding these efforts, and they'll have unlimited food and drink all
night.
That's
exactly right. You're exactly right. And then if you look at it too, because so many of the other organizations in the community that help with feeding the Salvation Army and the Sulzbacher Center and Catholic Charities and others, when they make an investment in this event, the money that would come to us ripples out to them because now we provide food to them. And the money that they're raising in the community doesn't have to go to food because they get that food from us. So an investment in the Three Squares event next Thursday night becomes an investment in the Sulzbacher Center and Salvation Army and others.
And let's talk about this event a little bit. It's $70 a person. Website is threesquaresjax.com. It's at the Prime Osborne next Thursday night. We mentioned Intuition Ale Works, but once you're in and you're a ticket holder, you can have as much as you want to eat and drink.
Yep, it's
all
grazing.
Night.
It's grazing. It's knock your lights out from 6:30 to 9. You know, there'll be places to sit and kind of catch your breath. There is a VIP section where there'll be some special food and drink, but then VIP ticket holders also have access to the whole event. It's come and enjoy and bring your friends, and it's going to be a wonderful evening. It's a very unique event in the community, and we're really excited, especially because of the quality of the entertainment and also the quality of the food entertainment that's be there.
Let's talk about you're going to have live music.
Yep.
You're going to have prizes.
Yep.
There's going to be a cooking competition, kind of, right?
Yep, we're working on that, and in fact, it's really fun because the restaurants vote among themselves for who they like the best among themselves.
Oh, nice.
And so it becomes a real, it's not like I like hamburgers better than fish or something, so now I'm going to vote that way. It's great. It's very cool.
They want those bragging rights.
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah.
That's right.
So I know you probably don't want to play favorites, but what are some of your favorite things to eat at this?
When you get to be my age, you have to worry about those things. So I try to go with the lighter fare.
Okay.
And things that I kind of look at and know what I'm eating. It's safer for me.
Oh, very diplomatic. Now, for people who've been listening, the easiest way to support this cause and help feed the hungry and food insecure is to just go to this event next Thursday night, 6:30 at the Prime Osborne Convention Center. You can buy tickets at the door. How else can people get involved and help?
For the event, they really just come into the event is the best way for them to do that. We've tried to utilize social media because we pulled this together pretty quickly. We try to use social media as much as we can for those of folks who struggle to read fine print like me. There's a 2-page spread in Folio this week, which has larger print that they can more easily read. There's a QR code on it that takes them right to where they need to be. So it's a Facebook pages, all the restaurants. We've really pushed this. We've pushed this pretty hard across the community.
And if they can't make the event, how else can people help this issue out?
Sure. There, as we tell folks, because so much of the food is donated to us through retail grocers, farms, packing houses, we don't have to. We do buy some food, but we don't have to buy a lot of it. So when they make an investment, a cash investment in the business, it goes directly to the warehousing and logistics operations to fuel for the trucks and the warehouse operations and distribution. So cash donations, of course, are always wonderful, and they can do that at our website, which is feedingnefl.org. Another way they can help is for volunteers. We need thousands of volunteers every year so that food that comes into the food distribution center can be inspected, repacked, and ready to go back out in the community right away. So thousands of volunteers are needed on a daily basis.
You need people to come to your warehouse and sign up.
Exactly. And they can do that online.
And where is it located again?
It's on the west side at Edgewood and First Street, sort of Edgewood and Commonwealth for folks that aren't familiar with the west side. It's in a big warehouse. We've leased a piece of space in a big warehouse facility there. And it works out to be a great logistics operations for us.
Again, it's Feeding Northeast Florida and their first annual Three Squares event benefiting all of the hungry and food insecure across 17 North Florida counties. This is coming up next Thursday night at the Prime Osborne. You can get tickets at the door or online at threesquaresjax.com. A delicious evening on tap. Executive Director Bruce Ganger, have fun.
Thank you very much.
And that's our program. Thanks so much for listening. Thanks to all of our guests and callers today as well. This show's producer is Sean Birch. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. If you have questions or comments about the show, just drop an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to catch our daily podcast. It's now up on iTunes. Next on Diane Rehm, a drawn-out dispute between shipping companies and dock workers is threatening vital ports along the West Coast. The White House sent Labor Secretary Perez to help broker an agreement. The West Coast port slowdown and implications for the U.S. economy. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow with our Friday Media Roundtable. Until then, have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.